This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. We will begin this last and very important session on a very central theme. It's a joy for me to welcome Dr. Jürgen Spies, whom I've known for many years through the work of IFES. I think the first time I've heard you lecturing were in the very early 80s at an IFES conference, and we've then met through the years. Jürgen has been the general secretary of the German student movement, SMD, for many years, and now he is the director of an influential institute in Marburg called Science and Faith. The subject for today concerns the historical reliability of the resurrection of Jesus. So a very central and important issue for us. Welcome, Jürgen.
This time I have joined the group of the scientists. And when I say to the scientists, I'm an historian, then I have to say, but I am a scientist. In Germany, history is science. First, that the question this morning is the historical reliability of Jesus' resurrection. And the first is the importance of the subject. And I will begin with the importance of the subject for my own life. I was not brought up from a Christian family. And when I was in school at 16, we had to decide whether to go to a language class for the next 3 years or to a mathematics. And I chose language. And from my class, only one boy did do that. So we were forced to sit side by side. And this boy was a Christian. And he said to me, Jesus Christ is risen from the dead. And I found this very good news, very interesting news, and started to read the New Testament. The others in the class said that he is a Christian for his parents are Christians. And that was true. His parents were Christian. But his explanation was that he is a Christian for Jesus has raised from the dead. And I thought, whether Jesus has raised from the dead has nothing to do with his parents or my parents. I must find the solution of another way. It's not a question of his or my parents. And then I studied mainly in Munich ancient history. That is a period of Greek and Roman history. And to increase my chance on the free market, I studied Egyptology. That does not mean that I can read all what I have written, for my handwriting is very bad. In the first, after half a year, I received from the teacher one sentence, you have made a good start besides your handwriting. And that did not become better when I studied Egyptology. I became a Christian when I was a student. I was, after this time, I was for 15 years general secretary of the IFES movement in Germany. I'm now the director of the Institute of Science and Faith. We have internet, and if you will look at this, we have most of the texts, nearly all of the texts, are in German, but there are a few in English and a few in Russian. So if you want to look at the Russian thing about anthropic principle, you'll find there an excellent text in Russian language on that. And schools are working with that. We have a paperback series. We have under this book, among these books, is a book of John Lennox, Has Science Buried God, with 5 editions in 3 years. And last month we published a book about neurotheology, neurobiology. Then we have seminars. We started last year with seminars for young apologists. And my main task is give lectures at universities or for churches or other organizations if they want to reach non-Christians. And I give that not only in Germany but in other parts of Europe, especially in Eastern Europe and in countries of the former Soviet Union. the lectures I give are on the question of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, or on Dostoevsky, or on C.S. Lewis, or the Da Vinci Code, or on science and faith, and on suffering. To my biography, is one part is that I'm married for the second time. My first family died by a car accident. That was long ago when the GDR was in existence, and I was sometimes speaking in the DDR, and it was not allowed to me. So when it was a bigger conference, they said, we have now a man here to give a word of greeting. And then I gave a word of greeting in 45 minutes. Afterwards, if a person had a question, I tried to answer it very short in another 45 minutes. So that is about my biography. And you see that the question of the resurrection of Jesus Christ was for me the starting point to deal with the question of Christianity. So it's very important for me. But it's not only my personal hobby to speak about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If you look at the New Testament, you'll find out that this subject is very important for the Christian belief. The resurrection of Jesus is the basis of the Christian faith. 1 Corinthians, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is in vain. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile and you are still in your sins. And Christian hope. 1 Peter, we have been born anew to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Therefore, Christians celebrate the resurrection of Jesus at Easter and on each Sunday worldwide. The historical question of Jesus' life and resurrection is very important for Christians. And therefore, Pontius Pilate is remembered in the Creed, suffered, crucified during the time of Pontius Pilate. Second, I call it historical research and reality. When I give lectures, I speak as an historian about the resurrection of Christ, not as a theologian, a philosopher, or a natural scientist. What is the special quality of an historian in that subject? Once I was sitting with a professor of physics in a panel discussion, and he was asked what he could say as a natural scientist about the miracles in the New Testament. His answer, what could I say about miracles? Miracles are by definition very rare, so you cannot reproduce it, what you like to do in natural sciences. So what could I say about that? And then he said, if you want to know whether a miracle in the New Testament did really happen, it is of no use asking a natural scientist. You should ask a historian. A historian can tell you how reliable the witnesses are. And that is the main point. Each science has different methods to deal with its subjects. Historians do not work like natural scientists. They work like lawyers. They judge according to evidence. They find evidence for their judgments in the books of others, maybe ancient historians, in inscriptions, papyri, letters, or in inscriptions of coins. They reconstruct ancient times from these sources. What we find in our books of history are reconstructions out of special sources. And one of their criteria is the question, is it plausible? And that is a problem for, as we all know, not only plausible things happen in history, not in the history of the world and in our own history. Sometimes very incredible things happen. In some newspapers, you find the column incredible, unbelievable. And then they tell you an incredible, unbelievable story. And for an historian, the question is, the more incredible a story is, the more importance we must give to the question, are the witnesses reliable? For that is one of the problems. We know all that there happen very unbelievable things in history. So the fall of the Berlin Wall was such an unbelievable thing. You can see in video that a few weeks earlier, experts say that will not come, not in many years, but it did happen. So the question in history is not, is it plausible, but did it happen? So that is a problem. Or in our own life, I think each of us has had experiences which are, if you tell them, are very unbelievable, but they happened. Okay, so that is, though, come to the point three, the historical sources about Jesus. the main historical sources about Jesus and the first Christians are found in the New Testament, the four Gospels, the book of Acts, and the letters. I now read a book from an historian about the Da Vinci Code, and he had, at the beginning he said, if that person is a pious evangelical or a hardcore atheist, all historians know that the only and best source for Jesus is in the New Testament, the text in the New Testament. There is not so much historically reliable outside the New Testament. The best-known exception is written by the Roman historian Tacitus in his book Annales. When he wrote about the fire in Rome in 64, he wrote something about the Christians. They were falsely accused as guilty, and as a result of this wrong accusation, they were killed, many of them. In this context, Tacitus saw the necessity of writing something about these people. Their name is derived from Christ, who was executed by the procurator Pontius Pilate in the time of Tiberius. And this is in precise accordance with what we find in the New Testament. So when we say the main source we have about Jesus and his resurrection is in the text of the New Testament, then we have immediately some questions to deal with. I have noticed two of them. First, were the authors of the Gospels interested in history? Often people say they, in ancient times, had other ideas about history. They were not interested in history as we see history. But when we look at the New Testament, we can answer this question with yes. What they reported did not happen sometime, somewhere, somehow, but in the specific time of Pontius Pilate or of Tiberius Augustus. And we can date the crucifixion of Jesus very precisely, as most of the historians do, the 7th of April in the year 30. His birth maybe was 7 before Christ, so Christ was born before Christ, but that is... So we are living now in the year 2013, after the birth of Christ. But we should not discuss this so much. Okay. So there's the first question. Are they interested in giving historical reports, or are they not interested? And the second, what I have mentioned here, did people in ancient times have other ideas of historical truth than we do nowadays? And a crucial word is here in the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. I read it for your remembrance. Luke 1, it's only one sentence but four verses. Luke 1, 1-4. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed. You can find many, at least 5 points out of this text. First, Luke is not the first one writing an historical report. He has other sources. Second, there were eyewitnesses. Third, he did own research. Fourth, he wrote it after order, maybe chronological or themes. And fifth, he wrote it for a man who had some knowledge of Christian faith, and now he becomes, with this report, some of the historical basis. And an ancient historian from the University of Göttingen, Ms. Helga Botermann, she has written an article some years ago to show that Luke really wrote like an historian, that you cannot say they had no interest in history. He was working like a historian is doing, and not only in ancient times, but till modern times. There were eyewitnesses, there were other reports, he did own research and all these things. And then he tried to combine that to a story with in a special order and out of a special purpose. And that is a very interesting point, that his report is rooted on eyewitnesses and in Acts on his own experiences. You find in Acts, he has written Book of Acts, and you find in Acts his we passages. And Mrs. Botermann says that it's very important to see that the people who have given him the information could judge what he had written. For this brings us to the second question, when were the reports written? When were the four Gospels which we find in the New Testament written in the form we can find them now? I have listed here two different timetables. There's one timetable, as it's the first, that is the opinion, at least in Germany, from most of the theologians who say the Gospel of Mark was written maybe in the middle of the 60s, Matthew and Luke after 70, and John in the 90s. When I've started first with research on the resurrection and with this questions of dating, my main question was, how do they know? And as you maybe you know, the main evidence, a crucial point, is the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. That is really, in all the books in Germany, the main question for dating the Gospels, Book of Acts, and even some of the letters. The question is, in the year 70, Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple was nearly destroyed, and so the question is, do we find anything about this destruction in the works of the New Testament? If we will not find anything, then all the books of the New Testament have been written before 70. But if we find something, they have written after 70. And so the question for Bible study is, do we find or do we not? And there is a debate more and more in Germany, for most of the theologians in Germany said we will find. You find the words in Mark or Luke when Jesus says about Jerusalem, here will no stone will stay, everything will be destroyed. And so people said, that is written after 70, after Jerusalem was destroyed. But that is not a real, not a totally convincing logical argument, for it says something about the person who has this argument. This person doesn't believe that a man is able to say something which happens after to predict something which come into existence after his death. Even if we not say anything about divinity of Christ, then it can be possible, and sometimes we find examples in history that people say something what really comes into reality after their death. But in meantime, since the 70s, there is another discussion. One leading man for this discussion was Bishop Robinson. He was one of the leading theologians of the God is Dead theology. He has written in 76 a book, Redating the New Testament. And he says that you will find in none of the books of the New Testament any hint of the destruction of Jerusalem. For this quotations, what Jesus is saying about the destruction of Jerusalem's, are quotations out of the Old Testament. And you can show that the authors did not know that it really happened. That was one of the main theses in this book, in the 76 from Robinson. And more people in Germany among the theologians and historians are following him. A few months ago, and for the first time, I think, since many decades, an ancient historian has written a PhD on the question, when was the Gospel of Luke and when was the Book of Acts written? And his thesis is that he thinks the Gospel of Luke was written in the 50s and the Acts not later than 65. And he deals a lot in, I have read this dissertation, he deals a lot in his dissertation with the question of what was the reality of the destruction in Jerusalem and how to bring the reality with the words of Jesus. And he says, you cannot combine that. And more and more, Riesner, another more or less famous evangelical professor of New Testament in Germany, some years ago said the same, that this argument of the destruction of the year 70 is not valid. You have some more problems. I will not go into details, but I want only to show you what is a common situation. It's from 65 to 95, or maybe it's in the 40s or 50s or 60s. At least you have a time difference from 40 years, or maybe the time difference is shorter. And how you have your timetable, is a question how to deal with the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. With the book of John, the Gospel of John, there is an interesting point that we have from his book, we have a very small paper, papyrus, which is found and which is dated between 100 and 125. I have read many books and articles on that question. I have found no theologian who says it's later than 125. And some say it must be between 100 and 125. And so we have a very interesting point. The book of John was written, as people say, in Germany it says, before they found this at the beginning of the 20th century, the people in Germany said it was written 160. And I think by the humor of God, they found this paper and say now this is a paper from 120, so it cannot be written on 160, so we do it on 100, 90 and 100. And now you have now the problem that the Gospel of John is written, say, maybe in 95. And now we have a text which is from the year 100, and we have 5 years difference between the first and the second edition, if that can really be true. So it's very near, that is far more nearer than the text we have from Tacitus or from Thucydides, Thucydides, and others people. I have here a list from the others, and it's very interesting. We have only two copies of Tacitus from his Roman history, one on the 9th century and one on the 11th century, so 700 or 900 years later. We have 8 copies from Herodot, Thucydides, and Josephus from the 9th century. That means sometimes 1,300 years later. I think 2,000 years later. But we have many copies from the 2nd century of bigger parts of the New Testament, only a few years or decades later. And to the friends of the Da Vinci Code, I can say that we can really see that in the middle of the 2nd century, the canon was more or less fixed. We can see it by the Canon Muratori, which was written between 150 and latest 180, I think. And there is a list what belongs to the canon, and there are 22 of the 27 books of the New Testament in this list, but there is nothing in this list what is not now in the canon. That's only for the friend of the Da Vinci Code. Now we come to the fourth point, the evidences of the resurrection. So historians work with sources and evidence, and now what is the evidence or are the evidence of the resurrections? I have said there are 3 points to discuss. First, the empty tombs. All the Gospels report that the tomb was empty on the third day. So they say Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That is on the third day, the Sunday, the tomb was empty. I have said here the main surprise is that there were women as witnesses. Pinchas Lapid, one of the most famous Jewish theologians in the last century, he died in the 90s. He was professor of New Testament in Frankfurt, has written many books. He was not a Christian, many books on questions of the New Testament, and he has written in the 70s a book on the question of resurrection. And in this book, he says the biggest surprise in the stories about the resurrection is that the first on the empty tomb and the first who met the risen Jesus were women. For their witness counted for nothing in their society of that time. Why then mention it? So if the Gospels would have been written later, then it would be more plausible to say Peter and Paul, or not Paul, Peter and the other apostles were the first witnesses. So in ancient times, I would give them this lecture and would say we had three witnesses for the empty tomb: the soldiers, the women, and the disciples. Then the people would say to me, "You spoke of three groups, but you name only two: soldiers and disciples. The third group is of no value." So that is for Lapid and for some others a big surprise. Why bringing in women as the first witnesses? And Lapid says the only reason for that is that it really had happened in that way. There is no other explanation for that. The other thing is, as you know, there was no jubilation about the empty tomb. It was not so that the disciples saw the empty tomb and say, "Okay, that's what we really expected. He will not stay here." But it's the opposite reaction to the empty tomb. They were not prepared for that. The disciples in that time, you can find it in the story, Emmaus story, they thought with the death of Jesus, every hope, everything was finished, was gone. Resurrection meant for them a resurrection after the end of the time, after the end of the world, a resurrection for everyone, for judgment. But they were not prepared about a resurrection within history for one person, for the Messiah, as a special point. So that was not with what whom they counted. Then the next thing I have listed, the empty tomb was not denied in ancient time. We find no texts in ancient time that people said there was no, the tomb was not empty. And more even in Germany, in the last 5-10 years, there were some articles that more and more theologians in Germany say that it is not thinkable that you have on the one side people saying Christ was raised from the dead, on the other side you can see the bones in the grave. That is, for today people can say that is not a question, for God can do everything. That's true, God can do everything. But for the ancient people to say here are the bones and you say he is risen, that in Jerusalem, that could this message could not stay very long. The question is, so we can all we can see, and more even skeptic people say the evidences for the empty tomb are very high. But that is not an evidence for the resurrection. The main question is, how did the tomb become empty? That is a question. Did they find the right tomb? Theft? So that is the accusation that the disciples had stolen the body of Christ out of the tomb. But even that accusation means that even the enemies of Christianity thought of a bodily resurrection. Otherwise, it would be of no use to say they had to steal the body, and if we find the body, we can say there was no resurrection. So it was really the word was of a bodily resurrection, and not only he was raised in higher spheres or So the empty tomb is necessary for the resurrection, but it's not sufficient. And that is very important. That's the same. It's necessary to play piano. It's necessary to have a piano, but that's not sufficient for me, for I cannot. So it's necessary for the resurrection, the empty tomb, but it's not sufficient. The main evidence is at point two. The meetings with the risen Christ, different places, different people. You find these reports in the Gospels, Book of Acts, and a very special thing in 1 Corinthians 15, in verses 3-6. And nearly all theologians think that we find in 3-6, or in the verses at the beginning of chapter 15, a very old formula. Paul says, it was delivered to me. That's a very old formula. And the question is, when this is an old formula, with these four verbs, crucified and buried, raised from the dead and seen, when this is a very old formula, when did Paul receive this formula? many of the people think that he could have received that when he was for the first time in Jerusalem, 3 years after he became a Christian. His conversion took place between 32 and 35. And 3 years later, he was in Jerusalem. That would mean that roughly 5-6 years after the crucifixion of Jesus, we have this very old formula, was died for our sins, buried, and then raised from the dead, and with the witnesses. That is a very short time. He must have received this formula before the year 51. For 51, he went to the Corinth, and then he had this formula for 50, in that year. Maybe it was from the middle of the 30s. The letters to the Corinthians was written in the year roughly 55, so you have a time difference of 25 years. So that would be the same when a person now would write something about the year 1981. And the most famous text, the most famous sentence in this quotation is this, that he wrote, Christ appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Even Ludemann, who was very critical in the 90s, had written a thick book against resurrection of Christ, even he states that it's... was no doubt that Paul really was convinced that these witnesses are there and the Corinthians did know them. So that is 81, 25 years time difference. If we had a special event in 81, which was crucial for our life, and more than 500 people have seen it, we could say similar things. Most of them are still alive, but not all. So this is a very crucial point, very strong argument for, in 1 Corinthians 15, the idea of Paul is not to give evidence for the resurrection of Christ, but to give evidence for the resurrection of the Christians. He tries to answer, in 1 Corinthians 15, the question, why can it be that Christians, that there are Christians who don't believe in the resurrection, when we all know that God has raised Christ from the dead? So its main point is not the evidence for the resurrection of Christ, but to give, with remembering on the resurrection of Christ, to give evidence that there is a resurrection for us all. The ascension of Christ, for some, even for some Christians, a problem, is the logical consequence of his resurrection. His earthly life was not finished when he was laid in the tomb, but with his ascension. This was the visible close of his life on earth. Third, the reactions of the disciples. Rudolf Bultmann was another enemy or was very distracted by the resurrection. He said there must have something crucial happened in the life of the followers of Jesus, for they have changed their life totally, even under, not under mockery only or persecution, even in facing death and being killed. They state with this message that God has raised Christ from the dead. That was a crucial message. And it's very interesting if you read the sermons in Book Acts that there's not so much discussion about ethics, but there's very much about the resurrection of Christ. Or in the letters you find always remembering the resurrection of Christ. So what was the cause for the revolutionary changes in their life? Some have said that was a product of hallucination, autosuggestion, self-deception. And to quote another time, Pinchas Lapid, he has written, to think that the message of the disciples about the resurrection of Christ was only the product of hallucination and autosuggestion, that would be a far bigger miracle than the resurrection itself. That is unbelievable for these people. They were no theologians discussing extreme ideas. They were more or less simple people, and they had made a very for them revolutionary experience. They were not interested in such form of doctrine or no such things. I close this with this question. Sometimes people tell me, did people in ancient times believe easier than we do after the Enlightenment? So we have a progress in man's history, and now I even heard that person said to me, maybe in ancient times on every corner some people resurrected or so. But that is not true. And if you read Tacitus or others, you see that people in ancient time could make decisions what is easy to believe and what is hard to believe. I can give you examples for that. Not out of the New Testament, out of other books. And I have listed here one example. After Paul's preaching on Jesus and the resurrection in Athens, he met three groups of listeners. His hearers thought that he would introduce two gods. So male god is Jesus and female is the resurrection. For in Greek times, they had always justice or so as being a god. And then you have three groups, people who mocked, so they said, we have never seen such a thing. People who put it off and say, if you come back next week, we can discuss it again. And then the third group, people who believed. And I think you will find these three groups till the end of the day. So when I give a lecture on the resurrection, that's more or less what I'm saying. Then I say that out of an historical point of view, it has a very good plausibility. Sometimes Christians are frustrated that I only speak of plausibilities, but everything what you say about Caesar or Constantine, we can say out of plausibility. How plausible is it to believe this or that? That are the sources. What do we think of that? So we cannot other things do in history. It's not only in ancient history and medieval or new history. What is plausible? And I close with a few remarks to say that it was not a miracle without any effect of us. But the resurrection was not a resurrection into the past, the resurrection of Jesus, as it was with Lazarus, who had died again, to die again, but it was a resurrection into the future. He is the first of the new creation. And then at the end, I tell a few things what the resurrection means for me personally, what that means for me. So it's not a miracle out of ancient time. I have listed here a few points. First, I say, for Jesus is raised from the dead, or God has raised him from the dead, therefore that what we are doing is not in vain. Or second, I tell the story where Paul says that he was in a situation that they even thought that say dying would be better than living, situation. And then he said, this happened so that we rely on God who raises the dead. And that, I think, is a very important point for my prayer life, that when I pray to God who raises the dead. That does not mean that all what I'm praying comes into fulfillment. As C.S. Lewis, who is often quoted in these days, said, sometimes we need to be thankful that God did not fulfill all our prayer. We would now be at the end of our life. And when I speak to students, I tell them sometimes, imagine only whom in the last year you always wanted to be married with. And then I have these other points, forgiveness of sin, peace with God, or that there is a judgment of righteousness of the world for victims and offenders. So that is more or less what I am saying when I speak about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And now I am happy for questions or discussions.
I've been interested to hear a little bit about the work of, I think it's a papyrologist called Jose Callahan, O'Callahan, who's been talking about some fragments of Mark that have apparently been found in amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls.
I cannot understand you, sorry. Maybe you are too near, or...
Is that easier? Okay.
Yeah, what's the question?
My question is about your opinion of... I think it's Jose O'Callaghan, who is a Jesuit papyrologist, who's been talking about some fragments of Mark I'd like to know your opinion of that. I asked some guys at Oxford about it, and they didn't have a terribly high opinion of it, but I'd like to know what you think.
That there is the argument that in the Qumran we find a short text out of the Gospel of Mark. And there are a few people, I think from Germany, Carsten Peter Tiede was a fan of that, and there are other, and I think, and others whom you mentioned thought that there is a short piece of chapter 6 of the Gospel of Mark, and that would be very early then. It would mean that in the 60s, there were reproductions of the Gospel of Mark. What I have seen is that most of the papyrologists, most of the ancient historians, don't believe that. So that is, and I have no own opinion to say that is true or not. I see that a few people think that isn't could be out of this text, but most of the people who deal with that don't believe it. So I cannot have no own.
Thank you very much for a very for an excellent lecture, very interesting and good. I was wondering how you would respond to a question that, well, what about all the critical scholarships? Are you reading are you doing a selection of scholars that support your point? How do you respond to such kind of a criticism?
My main point is that as an historian, we have to deal with sources which are reliable. And the sources of for the life of Jesus are really the things in the canon. Even Tacitus or even Flavius Josephus are later than what all, even the critical historians and theologians think about the four Gospels in the New Testament. Even if you think it's 65 to 95, even if you think that, these things are earlier than Tacitus and Flavius Josephus. And so that is one very crucial point for an historian to say what is the time difference. And the time difference is very short. And other things about Jesus are from the Gnostic Gospels are 2nd or 3rd or 4th century, and if you read that, you see that is not linked with a real story of Jesus. You cannot find a Jesus going from one place to another. It's mostly a Jesus discussing more or less hidden things with special people. And it's more dealing with his divinity, with some more or less fantastic stories about what he is doing, and in difference to what Lei Tibing is telling us in the Da Vinci Code, it's more a Christ who is not pro-feminism, it's more against and all these things. So I do not quote, I have not done so much quotation here with other. I have only quoted the sources and have tried to find out what is in the sources. Maybe I have only quoted two people who were non-Christians. Helga Botermann from the University of Göttingen and Pinchas Lapid from the University of Frankfurt. I found their statements for me very interesting, for it's not out of a special interest, only to bring some light in complicated discussions. And Helga Botermann from the University of Göttingen, where Lüdemann is, and her article she had dedicated to Gerd Lüdemann. But he doesn't remember him in the article, but it's a dedication to Lüdemann. The other thing is, I have only time space for my lecture. I always speak only about 45 minutes. You can speak about everything, but not more than about 45 minutes, is a saying in Germany. And So I tried to go with the arguments and with the original things. And then if in the auditorium people have other ideas, then we can discuss them. And then I think that I know the arguments against. But I hear say what historian can say and where the problems are. And therefore, for me, it's an important point first to say what are the methods, this question of reconstruction evidence, and what are the questions about the reliability as historical books of the Gospels and the Book of Acts, with this Luke quotation or other things, and the question, what is the time difference between that? And sometimes I close with a question that what is not a question for a historian, it is a question of the presupposition of if we think that this world is only a product of chance and necessity, or whether we think this can be a product of an intelligent person who can act in history. If I exclude this, then I have to find other interpretations of the miracles of the New Testament. But if I think you cannot exclude that this world is product of an intelligent person, then maybe add to the singularity of this world, this person has added some other singularities with the resurrection. And the main point, I think, the main point is that it is not a normal historical fact, but it is said that God has raised him from the dead. We as historians can see only the results. We can say there is an empty tomb, there are the reports about the meetings with Jesus, and there are the changes in the life of the disciples. But that are all that are results of what the New Testament says was a deed, was something God has done. So sometimes I speak about that, for people think there cannot be such things like miracles. But this is not a question of an historian, but it is a question what a man has as a presupposition.
I wasn't quite clear about what you were saying in relation to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Were you saying that that was a good argument for saying that the Gospels were written early? Were you agreeing with that? In which case, do you also think that John was written at 90, in which case you'd expect John to mention it?
With the Gospel of John, first is a question, as I said, in Germany, till the beginning of the 20th century, people, the leading theologians said it was 2nd century, 162 to the end. Then they found this papyrus and knew that at the beginning of the 2nd century, we found a copy of the Gospel of John far away from Ephesus. So it must be earlier. And therefore, they said it must be 19-100, so very near to the thing. This papyrus could be from the year 100, so you cannot go later than 100. You must very near to 95 and 100. But then you have really the interesting point that you have nearly no time difference between the first writing of the Gospel and the paper we do have now today. That is very unusual, totally unusual. Whether the Gospel is earlier, there are a few people have... Robinson, he said he had written the next book he has written about the Gospel of John, and said maybe it was in the 50s. And one of the most famous German theologians, who is writing many books, Peter Berger from the University of Heidelberg, he has written in 98 a book, not referring, I think, no sentence referring to Robinson, and the book has the title, In the Beginning Was John. So he has the same thing, what Robinson said. These arguments for dating late in the 90s are not, you can't hold these arguments. They are all combined with the year 70. And if this argument fails, then it's open. And then you have another problem if you turn the argument around and say there is nothing about the destruction. Then all the works, all the 27 books in the New Testament must be written in the form we have it before the year 70. Then you have everything. Second letter of Peter, everything. That's what Robin Hood is doing. He says, we found no argument. But you have in the text of, if it's a gospel or the letter, we have often Jerusalem, we have often something about the temple, but there's no argument to find that the people knew that there is no Jerusalem now, that there is no temple now, say Hippo. And one other very complicated question is what this ancient historian dealt with in his PhD, the Book of Acts. If you read introduction books, you find Book of Acts is later than Luke. Luke is after 70, therefore Book of Acts after 80. It's very logical, this line. But it depends whether Luke is really after 70. And if you look without this combination with a then you see that Acts is really problematic to think that Acts was written later than 65. And in this PhD, the man says it is nearly unbelievable that it was written after 65. And that is one of his main theses. And if he can hold this, and there were other historians, not theologians in Germany, other historians who said that they don't believe out of the text that it's later than 65, and then you must go with Luke in 61 or whatsoever. So these things are combined. In Luke is one of the most question is, what is the last, that's the Bible quiz, what is the last word in the Book of Acts? What is the last word? Does anyone know? Yes, he stayed in home and was teaching unhindered. That's the last word. And now the question is, why is this the last word in Book of Acts? Does that mean that the Book of Acts were written while Paul was still alive, or does that not mean that? So that is one of the discussions. And there is in the Book of Acts is a reference between Jerusalem and Rome. There's a sentence Paul makes, and then he said, is it plausible that this sentence was written after the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans? So these are the questions. So we have two different. We have one, the question of the Gospels with the 70 question, and then we have the question of Acts in the combination with the Gospel of Luke.
About 50 years ago, I read a book. I bought it in England. There was a lawyer who wrote it, who decided to destroy Christianity by proving the resurrection hoax. To prove that the resurrection is just a hoax. And he spent, I think, more than a year to study the historical sources and everything, and he wrote a book, Who Moved the Stone, by Frank Morrison. And this was even in Germany published by Fischer, which is a secular paperback series. Which is gives a very good evidence how people, if they thoroughly and honestly look into the matter, will see that there is no other explanation for the resurrection, that really God raised Christ of the dead. And this book was republished, I think, about 5 years ago in England in paperback.
Yes, in German as well.
So. In German.
A few years back, I found some evidence, some extra biblical text where they referred to the day before a Passover feast, the first day of the Passover. In the Old Testament, it refers to the first day of the feast as a Sabbath day. And it also, this document referred to that day before the feast Passover as a day of preparation. I think the Greek word is paraskuo or something. I'm not sure what exactly the Greek word on that. Together with the fact that in Matthew 28, verse 1, it says after the Sabbaths, the Greek is plural there. Do you think there's any possibility And have you researched into the possibility of a Thursday crucifixion? And have you seen, have you investigated the evidence that I've mentioned?
I have not done so much research on that. As I have written here, I believe in this to say that the day of crucifixion was the day before the Sabbath. I think I have quoted the verses, and that according to the Gospel of John, that it was, besides that, it was the day before the Passover. There is a discussion to bring this together. I have only read some theologian historians about that, and some work with different calendars. There have been different calendars in that time. Maybe this will help us. But I found this, for me, till now, sufficient. So I have no problem to say this Friday, Sunday. Sunday as a day of when they found the empty tomb, as a third day from Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I, till now, stay with this Friday.
If I could just add on to that, I found a reference in the Talmud about how the Jews count time, and they counted time by half days, called annas, and a day anna would be from 6 in the morning to 6 in the evening, and the night anna 6 in the evening to 6 in the morning. I've gone through the different timings in the Bible and also used that set of timings to look at the timings regarding the crucifixion and resurrection, and everything seems to work out. The problem we have in Muslim evangelism is that Muslims say he was in the tomb 3 days and three nights. Mm-hmm. Can we count on our fingers days and nights? And they come up with 3 days and two nights. And so in regard to Muslim evangelism, this is a topic that is become relevant.
Regarding what you were saying about John's Gospel and the latest evidence, what do you think about some of the previously published material by one particular American academic on Thomas's Gospel, in which she castigates and attacks quite strongly the reliability of John's Gospel in its entirety, and suggests that Thomas's Gospel ought to be in the canon in its place? How would these type of academics relate to the latest information that you've just shared with us?
I did not really catch the question, sorry.
Okay. I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a book published about Thomas's Gospel, in which the author, an American academic whose name escapes me, strongly suggests that Thomas's Gospel ought to be in the canon in place of John's Gospel, because she accuses it of being written much later. So I'm wondering how the latest evidence that you've just shared with us will affect the opinion.
Which Gospel should come in the...
Thomas's Gospel.
Thomas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, Elaine Page, or sorry, I couldn't think of a name.
Yeah. The earliest dating of the Gospel of Thomas is 140, as far as I can see. Then Thomas is not a real Gospel. Thomas, 114 words of Jesus. There is no story, so you have not Jesus speaking, healing, or going around. There's no story in that. It's only one word or parable and such things. There are some parables which we find in the New Testament. Some are very identical. Some are changed. And some theologians think Jesus would have said more than what we find in the Gospels. Why should not some of the words be from Jesus, which we find in the Thomas Gospels. So from the Gnostic Gospels, many think the Gospel of Thomas could be more or less authentic, or some of the words. But in this Thomas Gospel, there are words which are hard to believe that they are from Jesus. The last sentence, I have it only in German, the last 114, for example, is that Jesus says to Peter that they want to make Mary, I think, from female to male, so that she can come to heaven and so. So it's really not pro-feminism, the text. And you find more of these within the 114 fragments. So that I think the majority of theologians in Germany are totally against to think that you have here some real things. For some of the words in the Thomas Gospel are definitely not you are not able to bring them together with what Jesus says about women in the four canonical Gospels. So I don't think that the Thomas, even if you found a few words, would you think, why not? There are some which really are very strange, what he says, especially about women.
Okay, just one or two more questions before we are going to close this.
I have a question concerning the solar eclipse at the time of Jesus' crucifixion. And I came across some of the statements that I guess Phlegon, however you say it in English, was writing actually, and I guess Origen and Julius Africanus supposedly wrote and commented on Phlegon, mentioning that there was a solar eclipse at the time when there is a full moon, which is astronomically impossible. Do we have any more evidence on those statements or not, or comments?
What is the version?
Dealing with the solar eclipse when Jesus Christ was crucified, and the darkness and the earthquake, supposedly mentioned in other ancient documents Phlegon and I guess Philippon and some others. Do you have any comments, or maybe are those things accurate? Or
there is a text which people think of the 50s, not in the Gospel, is later, but it's going back to the 50s, where it's the same what is called Mondfinsternis, darkening of the moon, and these things is written that should have been taken place in that time. But I have no, I don't know whether there are research about, I don't know about that.
Just a quick question on it. From the from liberal scholarship, what is the area in terms of evidence for the resurrection that liberal scholarship is traditionally focused on, sort of for most criticism, or where it sees as sort of the weakest point to attack the evidence for the resurrection on?
What does that mean?
Is there, in terms of the evidence, the range of evidence for the resurrection, when liberal New Testament or liberal historians, or forget the liberal side, historians generally, where has traditionally been seen as the weakest point that people have tended to attack and say there is not good evidence for the resurrection?
I think the main point is really the philosophical side. Well, nothing has to do with the history, so that it's unbelievable to think that there is a God who deals with our history. Even if you think there is a God who had started the thing, but he will not intervene in making such things. I think that is the main point. And in Germany at least, is more and more positively seen is really the question of the empty tomb. That people think it's not plausible to think that the tomb was not empty. So that more and more people, but that had nothing to do with the resurrection. The question is, why is it empty? So that is what people say, okay, maybe it was empty. The question is, how did it become empty?